Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show.
Fish, plankton, torture cinema from Skiffy and Fanti.
Amazing.
I love you, Paul.
Paul's the best.
I'm Sean.
I'm Jen.
I'm Rachel.
I'm David.
And I'm Paul.
And I'm Julia.
And we are here for torture cinema. We are discussing someone's childhood. Whose childhood are we destroying today?
Mine.
We're not destroying anyone's childhood because this is a good movie and no one's going to hate it.
What Julia said.
We yep. will see.
Ditto.
No, everyone can't like this movie. That's
Sorry.
Not right.
Everyone does like this movie. It's
this
not
movie
even,
is amazing.
I'll save this. I'll save this for... Yeah.
No.
No. It's not a bad movie. It doesn't even have a bad rating on Rotten Tomatoes or IMDb. It's
My
fresh on Rotten Tomatoes.
My first dislike is that somebody nominated this movie for torture cinema.
It won an Oscar.
It's David's fault. I told David to come up with a movie from his childhood that was bad, and he picked this one. He's like, well,
David.
I liked it, but everybody else hated it.
I thought it would give people more to work with than the other two options, which were When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth and Yogg Monster from Space.
I feel like both of those would probably have been better choices for torture cinema. I just feel like it's just from the title alone.
It's like David going like, oh, well, you know, this is the worst movie from my childhood because I only watch good movies.
The problem was it had to be a movie that I liked in my childhood that other people did not, and it was a bomb. I thought of the worst movie that I saw in my childhood was Mysteries from Beyond Earth, and I hated that when I was 10.
Why aren't we watching that movie?
Because he hated it.
Yeah. And the whole point of this is that last time we watched one of Paul's beloved movies and we all hated it and Paul felt really bad and we all felt really sad and we thought we should eviscerate someone else's childhood since we had already done that to both Paul and Sean, who for some reason likes Mac and Me.
Because what?
Great. That movie is great.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. It's true. It's amazing.
Mine will be Waterworld, obviously, mm-hmm. So you can all eviscerate me first.
Oh, God, well, no. Jen, you don't understand. When I was in marching band in high school, the show that we did junior year was the music from Waterworld.
That's amazing!
Yes, and we all dressed up in costume while we were marching.
Oh my God!
Okay,
is there like picture or video of this?
Right? I must have it.
I have the VHS of it somewhere. I'd have to see if my dad put it on a DVD.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
I will just say then, I had not known Jen would come on this episode. This was very last minute. So for the next poll, I will stick Waterworld in the poll for Jen. Because we have been talking about Waterworld since...
the greatest movie ever.
Oh, hold on, Jen. You need pause just for a second, please. We have been talking on and off about this movie for years. It comes up anytime Jen is on a torture cinema movie. We say we're going to do Waterworld, and Jen's like, I love that movie. It's the greatest movie in the world. And I keep telling her it is one of the worst things that God has ever given us. And so it is now going to be on the poll.
It is one of the only two movies that has made me yell fuck off at the screen in a theater.
Wow.
The music is good, but the movie is
We should
terrible.
Save that for a future podcast, guys, and talk
and
about Logan's Run.
If you've ever met David, that saying right there is alarming, because it's hard to imagine David yelling fuck off at all. Wow. Okay. Well, on that note, maybe we should mention what we're drinking and actually get to discussing Logan's Run. Sound good?
Sounds good.
Sounds like a plan.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll start with you, Jen. What are you drinking, ma'am?
I'm drinking something that I find slightly disturbing. It's an almond roca wine.
What?
Why are you actually drinking? Like, I actually have a bottle of that from a place in Boise that I went to with my parents. But I would not drink it because that shit is cloying. Instead, I pour it over ice cream like God intended.
Well, yeah, I poured it over copious amounts of ice, at least. It's a little bit worrisome as a substance. It's not terrible tasting. It's just
weird.
Yeah. Questionable.
Yeah.
So sweet.
So sweet.
Fair enough. All right, Rachel, what are you drinking?
I am drinking an amaretto sour, which was not made for me by my awesome roommate, Kathy. And so instead, I attempted to make one for myself, which I did by following the directions on the back of the sweet sour bottle. And that involved a lot of, like, taking out measuring cups and being like, how many fluid ounces are in a cup? And it turned out okay. It's just, like, not awesome and foamy and shaken.
What kind of weirdo follows directions?
Someone who wants her drink to taste good.
That's a perfectly rational response, Rachel. David, what about you?
I'm a scientist!
David?
I'm drinking a lime Diet Coke to make a change from the Red Rose tea.
Fair enough, fair enough. All right, Paul?
I am drinking just plain water.
That is a very interesting choice.
It's a rather odd choice, I know, because we're not watching Waterworld, but I digress.
Oh, it's going to be interesting when we do Waterworld. What drinks people will come up with?
Oh, I already know.
I will be coming up with one that will have pee in the title.
I will be drinking a salted beer.
Fair enough. All right, Julia, what about you?
I haven't been feeling super great this week, so I'm drinking a nice warm mug of water with a juice of a lemon and a bunch of grated ginger in it.
That sounds better than my water.
Yeah, no, it's very good on the throat.
Tell me about the waters of your home world, Julia.
God.
Fair enough. Well, I am drinking the last of my orange juice and the last of my weird Russian vodka mixed together. I did not use measuring cups, Rachel. I just realized...
That's because you're not a scientist.
So we call this a Sean screwdriver?
Well, I also decided that I would just put in frozen fruit to serve as ice cubes. So there's a whole ton of frozen fruit. It's actually really quite delicious.
That does sound good.
Yeah, the frozen fruit's all melting. It's not melting. It's like thawing, I guess. I don't know, whatever. But it's good. Yeah, and I will be very intoxicated this episode. So on that note, maybe we should get to starting talking about Logan's Run. And I feel like, since this is from David's childhood, perhaps he should be the one to describe it to us.
I concur.
Well, this certainly marked me when I saw it. It takes place in the 23rd century, in the wake of all kinds of apocalyptic wars, and the exterior world is apparently unlivable, or so everyone believes, and the remainder of humanity lives inside a city known as the City, which consists of a number of gigantic geodesic domes. Everything is very utopian from a consumer point of view, but at the age of 30, the crystal that is in your palm turns black, and you must go to Carousel, which involves dressing up like Jason Voorhees trying out for ABBA and going to a cross between an arena, amusement park, and crematorium. Logan, played by Michael York, is a sandman whose job it is to kill the runners, people who don't want to explode at age 30. He's enjoying his work, though is asking himself a few questions about it. And then the computer, which apparently governs this world, it's kind of neat that we have a dystopia with no actual leaders, wants him to track down a apparent mythical or real place called Sanctuary, where the unaccounted for runners have gone. His crystal is then aged so he can pass himself off as a runner to the underground, and he and Jenny Agutter begin a kind of ADD picaresque flight through the city to try to find sanctuary, and encountering all sorts of odd characters along the way.
I got a question for you, David.
Hmm?
Have you read the novel?
Yes, yes, I have. Actually, just this week, I was going to actually some of my likes are actually connected to some of the changes and some of the things that were retained from the novel.
Yeah, I had read the novel before I ever saw the movie, and the copy of the novel I had some stills from the movie, and so I was like, wait,
that's my copy.
That copy of mine went to got battered into extinction. But yeah, I said, so wait a minute, this is seen, isn't it, in a book? It was rather confusing.
And it's William F. Nolan, correct?
And George Clayton Johnson.
Fair enough. So, David, how did you get the novel? Because I actually tried to track it down, but I couldn't find a version in print.
Oh, I found it at the this is one of the books I've got at the Children's Hospital Book Fair here a couple of years back. It's this huge used book sale that we have every year, and you find all kinds of stuff there. So yeah, I probably picked that up for 60 cents a couple of years ago.
Oh, that's nice, because yeah, when I tried to find it, like, I couldn't find any copies for under like $40, and I was not gonna pay that.
Yeah, it's out of print and rare, and I lament not having a copy.
Library sales are lovely. I just discovered, and David will probably appreciate this, I found a copy of Colossus, which was eventually made into a movie called Colossus and the Forbin Project.
Yeah.
Which is actually, I think, a really good movie. So...
And I believe that book had two sequels.
Yeah, Colossus, The Fall of Colossus and Colossus and the Crab.
Yeah.
Yep. I've not read those. They were not turned into movies. But any case, well, there we go. So now you know what Logan's Run is about, although I suspect many people probably recognize certain tropes and features of Logan's Run because they've been repeated throughout pop culture for decades, which is kind of fun. We're doing something that people will recognize. But we have changed the format of this a little bit, so instead of doing five likes and dislikes, we're now going to do three so that we can get this into a little bit more of a manageable size. I think it'll be fine, because three just means that we're going to have a really weird mixture of different likes and dislikes. So I think we should dive right in, and we're going to start with you, Jen, your first like.
Yay! Okay, since I'm the token, moron of the group, I'm going to go with something really easy. I think my favorite thing about this movie is Farrah Fawcett's hair.
It is fabulous.
Wow.
So amazingly stunning. It has like a life of its own. It takes over the screen when she comes on. It's gorgeous.
Its performance is more striking than hers.
Well, yes.
Hey.
Absolutely true. Absolutely.
You keep that to yourself, David. We're going to talk about that later.
It is very, very big and lustrous.
It brought me some sort of joy. I don't know why, but the second she showed up, I was like, all is right in the world.
Question for everybody. Since she works as, I guess, like the receptionist at a plastic surgery facility that changes your face and or body, do you think that she has, like, that is not her original face?
Oh, I would be surprised if that were her original face.
Okay. Because I got the impression that she had been under the, I guess it would be the laser now, many times, that she had changed her face considerably, because she didn't seem to be particularly interested in much other than appearance.
The book, her character is actually, her scene is almost identical to the one in the book, and there it's strongly suggested that she's sexually turned on by the plastic surgery.
Yeah,
so that's... other people's transformations does it for her.
Yeah.
Hence the go for dark hair.
Dark hair.
So
that
creepy.
Is interesting, because that does, if you kind of think about it in those terms, her performance is very different. It's much
if you think
odder.
About the entire sort of mythos that is created within the world of the idea of renewal, she's basically watching people go through many renewals, which is pretty powerful, heady stuff within their worldview.
That is fair, and that is something that I think we'll be coming back to.
Her hair. It's gorgeous. I want it. There you go.
All right. So you can send donations to jenzink@gmail.com.
Seriously.
And she will go get her $150,000 haircut. I don't know how much haircuts cost. I'm just assuming that's what that would cost.
Probably.
So wait, Jen wants to have that haircut, or she wants to have Farrah Fawcett's actual hair?
Well,
her actual
the latter would be obviously really hard to acquire.
I was
at
wondering
this point
if we should send someone out to shave Farrah Fawcett's head.
Didn't she pass away a couple years ago?
Yes.
So that would involve...
You could still shave her head. It's probably perfectly preserved.
Yeah, but it probably
doesn't. She'll fight you less.
Float as perfectly as it used to. So
the Skippy and Fandy show does not advocate grave robbing.
Remember, hair does not hair does not rot the way that flesh does. So
true.
As I said, the Skippy and Fandy show does not advocate grave robbing. Even hair. Oh my god,
gosh. This podcast went in a weird place right off the bat. Thanks, Jen!
I'm so sorry. I thought I was just, giving us all something really simple to start with that we could probably all agree upon.
And it went, okay. Rachel, please go to your first like and save us.
My first like is... It's actually a like similar to what I had when we saw Omega Man. There were some bitchin' 70s costumes in there. I mean, for the most part, I actually was quite charmed by the costume design in this movie. apart from, after a while, what's her name? The woman that was escaping with Logan, kind of her artfully torn dress got to be a bit silly.
I don't know. I have this as a like and a dislike. I have those costumes, and it's just like those costumes.
Well, yeah. Though I mean, I gotta say, like Logan's, like robe thing that he's wearing when that looked. I mean, it looks like he's wearing a bag, but it looks super comfortable,
okay,
which is
my
really
dad
what he had a robe.
Owns robes like that.
No,
so they're
no.
totally legit. Oh, and they're ridiculously 70. Comfortable. It's the male version of the muumuu. And they're amazing.
Kind of like a bag, but kind of like a wizard.
Yes.
You're a wizard, Logan.
He's a wizard. David, jump in, David.
Well, I was going to second Paul's thing because on the one hand, I agree with. I mean, I was grooving off them too, but my younger self, who was borderline traumatized by the initial viewing of Carousel and the robes and the masks. Though I first saw this film on a small black and white TV, and I didn't realize those were masks they were wearing. I thought it was makeup. Anyway, so I thought the monk like robes they were wearing were really quite striking and spooky. But watching this again the other day, when they removed the robes and they were wearing those white bodysuits with the very fetching racing flames on them.
helps them go faster to death. Yeah,
well, exactly. Uh-huh. Talk about hot yoga.
That is true. All right, David, what about your first like?
My first like, well, I'm going to go with the City of Domes exteriors. So the domes themselves and then the views of the skyline inside the domes. Because that, I think, probably more than anything else was what stuck with me as a kid. I just... And all the little stories and sort of cartoons that I did as a child with any kind of science fiction setting, it was always the City of Domes that I was recreating. That just was the future for me for a long, long time. And so every time I watch it and we begin with that tracking shot towards the City of Domes, it's like, oh yeah, I'm home. And the interior, it does look a lot like an album cover of the Alan Parsons Project, but I mean that in the best way possible.
You're right, though, that domes seem to appear quite a lot in the 70s. I mean, even Silent Running is like the main ship has
domes
I
in
think
space.
Like four domes or something like that. Yeah, so there's quite a lot of domes. And I wonder, it would be interesting to look back across films of the 70s to see how often domes are associated with life or salvation of life.
Or the future. Look at Epcot Center.
Yeah, that's a fair point, yeah.
Or the and even before that, though, there's a similar thing. There's a big geodesic dome in Montreal that was part of Expo 1967. So, and it was for the Habitat for Humanity area.
That's interesting. Yeah, somebody should do that. This is like someone should go write a book basically about domes. So, Jen?
Well, they do look a bit like boobs, life-giving.
But there's lots of them.
Lots of them.
Lots of boob-shaped
domes.
No, I thought
it was interesting because, you know, I hadn't seen the movie in years. I do remember loving it as a kid, but I thought the entire thing took place underground. So having, you know, going back and watching it again, I'm sitting there going, wait a minute, why are there domes? This is all supposed to be taking place underneath things. And that's why they can come out at the end. I was very surprised to find that my memory was that far off.
But in fairness, a lot of the action does feel like it's underground, especially once the run actually begins.
Yeah.
Then and they were being told that he keeps going down and down and down. So I think once they're properly into the underground, it does imply, it does feel very undergroundish.
Well, even the mall and the carousel, the entire thing is fairly claustrophobic.
Yeah, the one time they fluff it, I think, is early on when Logan and Francis are standing on the steps of the Sandman headquarters, and we're very clearly getting sunlight on them,
yeah.
Which runs counter to when they see the sun for the first time much later in the film. It's such an obvious exterior shot when the rest of the film is in the city, is carefully kept interior.
Yeah.
Mm. Fair. Paul, what, you want to jump in? I know you said that you had something similar to Rachel. Did you want to kind of jump on that or add something new?
I'm going to add something new since we're only doing 3x3. I got plenty. Okay, so my first like is going to be the new U Shop. I mean, we already mentioned Farrah Fawcett's impressive hair, but I remember the new U Shop vividly from the book and seeing it come to life, including Doc, who's has only worked on himself, and that awesome laser sculpting chair thing of death. It looks like the 70s version of the future, what people would do just to pass the time. And in the book it's mentioned there's lots of these new U Shops, but I get the impression in here it's probably just one, because it's just one city. So I like the idea. I like the idea of the new U franchise, and just like all these people with all these chairs resculpting themselves over and over again, just on a whim, and with no mess and no blood until you turn off that safety.
And it's weirdly sort of predictive, because I don't know what the status of plastic surgery was in the 70s. I'm assuming it existed in some form. But if you look at, you know, plastic surgery as it's perceived today and its widespread use, in some places even sort of aggressively so, and it's a weird way in which it sort of predicts or unintentionally predicts the kind of way in which plastic surgery or changing one's face or body would be sort of become culturally ubiquitous and normal.
Well, I think face is still more common than body, because in the book, and David can back me up on this, because they go into a whole discussion, oh, maybe we should make myself shorter, and they talk about all the things they can do to the body. I mean, here they just say, oh, just want a face, but it's clear the new U-Shop can do all sorts of things.
Yeah, that's true. And disturbingly so. Yeah.
Disturbing when things go wrong, but yeah.
In the book, is the new U-Shop as obsessed with looking more youthful as it is in the film?
I think it's more just looking different, right? Because one of the things that's different in the book is that there you die at 21,
right?
So looking more youthful isn't really the issue.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Yeah. The book couldn't. They had to extend the the ages in the movie because the book, yeah.
Well, there's a lot that gets really creepy once you take all the scenes you've seen in the film, mm-hmm. and make everyone 10 years younger.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was a piece of trivia on IMDb that said that they changed it to 30 because they realized that from a marketing perspective, it would be very difficult to market a movie full of under 21-year-olds.
Well, in the book, they don't have those teleporters to have sex. They basically go to this glass-enclosed place where you basically find romantic partners, and Logan goes there because he's lonely, and he meets this 13-year-old who hasn't turned red yet. He says that I'm still a blue. You'll find me more skilled beyond all others. At the time when I read this, I wasn't screwed out. Now I'm thinking about, like, okay, a 20-year-old and a 13-year-old? Maybe not so much.
That is super creepy by comparison to what the film does.
I mean, yes. On the one hand, it's interesting that if you think about it, the ages of the characters in the original book were pretty much what you'd get in your typical YA dystopia today, except for the strong, the pervasive sexual aspect, which you keep, is very squick-inducing over the course of the novel.
That's interesting.
Well, that's kind of interesting because some of the YA dystopians are really obsessed with sex, too. Like, there's one where in the world, if you turn 16, you're then ready for sex, and you get, like, a tattoo engraved on yourself that says 16, or they call it sexteen. And the whole point of that is, like, what happens when you turn 16 and you're expected to have sex with everybody.
But that's that's very much the point of the book, or being explored?
I think so. I haven't actually read this. I had it described to me by Melinda Lowe on a panel in 2012. So I think you can actually listen to that panel if you want to dig up the Outer Alliance podcast of it. But we did a panel on YA dystopians, so I read a few of them in preparation for that panel, and that wasn't one of them, but it was like one of the ones that she brought up, where basically there are a lot of YA dystopians now where there's a lot of emphasis on sex and or pregnancy and like teenage girls being used to breed.
Yeah, without having read any of those, I couldn't say, but the book feels much more like, I mean, it's essentially the implication is once people hit 14, then it's full on, and there's hardly a suggestion of this being questioned or examined in the book.
I expect it to be questioned in this society. I mean, if in the book everybody is going to die at 21, then they have 7 years of their adult life, which start at 14.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. I guess nonetheless, I'm very conscious of, as Paul said, that we have Logan, who is 21, having sex with characters who are 14.
Oh, no, I find that totally squicky. I think it's totally squicky. I just can see how no one in that society would question it.
Yeah, yeah. It contextually makes sense, but the context itself is disturbing.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair. So maybe we should save some of this sex talk, because I suspect it's going to come up somehow. It is something related to one of my likes. But I suspect it also is going to appear in the dislikes. But maybe we should jump to Julia for her first like, so we can kind of move on a little bit. Julia, you want to jump in?
Okay, so tying everyone's likes together, my first like is the whole aesthetic of the film. Literally that is what I had written down on my paper. I didn't choose one specific aspect of it. I just thought the whole thing was kind of amazing and 70s futuristic. The domed city kind of reminded me a lot of Tomorrowland and Disneyland. I love the pneumatic tube sort of people mover transportation. Rachel points out in the chat the cell phones. The costumes were amazing. The new U shop was amazing. The whole look of the domed city. And then, like, once you got out into the outside world, like, even though some of it didn't make a whole lot of sense, I didn't really understand how these ice caves existed, but they were still, they looked kind of amazing. And the ruins of DC with the vines, everywhere, mm-hmm. and the cats all over in the Senate. Oh, that was just fantastic. We were like, a Senate full of cats. And one of my friends said it would be more adorable than the real Senate. And then one of my other friends said, yeah, probably more productive. but yeah, and like that, and also the big water intake thing where they actually escape and then come back into, which turns out to be in Dallas, Texas, or Fort Worth, possibly. And it's a water garden.
Yeah.
Nice.
Cool. And it actually exists. It closed for a while in the early 2000s after, unfortunately, some people drowned. Some children fell in, and then I guess an adult tried to rescue them, and the whole group drowned.
Oh, goodness.
But they have reopened it because I guess one of the things that made that happen was the fact that the pool was 9 feet deep, and it's now only a couple feet deep, so you can't as easily fall in and drown. So you could actually go there is the point. Like, you could go to that water garden.
Is that the thing at the end with the staircase kind of thing?
Yeah, the big thing with all the terraced steps. You can walk on those in real life.
That looked terrifying to me to dive into that. It looked really scary.
Well, you would not want to dive into that, especially now that it's only like two feet deep.
Well, today definitely would be a good reason not to dive in because you smack your face. But I'm guessing it was 9 feet deep back then.
Yeah, it was 9 feet deep until the early 2000s. And so, like, you could have actually dived in. And I'm assuming when they did it for the film, they actually did dive into it.
So I just wanted to add a quick piece of trivia to this, Julie, because you've raised the sort of the visuals of this. It was actually nominated for several awards, and it did receive a special award at the Academy Awards for its visuals, so, which is cool.
For visual effects, right. So I'm unclear on whether that actually, like, what that actually means.
I think it included,
but yes, it did.
The when they got to the city in particular, because it's Washington, D.C., and it's in ruins, and as you mentioned, right, with the vines and everything, and the kind of the sort of decay of the city. I feel like that's what it primarily was represented for in terms of the visual effects, although some other things it may have been for as well earlier in the film, such as the domes,
Well, it
the
might
domes,
have been for the domed city.
Well, like, yeah, because, yeah. I mean, visual effects would be something like you know, the I guess some of the scenes inside, because otherwise, I mean, things like the vines and so forth, that would probably fall under production design, right?
Yeah.
Well, although right. some of those look like they were, from the sort of distance shots, didn't look like they were designed in terms of, like, they looked like they were either models or matte paintings. That makes sense.
Mm. Oh yeah, they were. There's definitely a lot of model work going on there.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
But yeah, I assume that special award is probably more to do with the city than the outside. However, there was like that moment when those of us who had not already seen the movie before, which included me, saw and recognized that it was DC for the first time, which is when you see the Washington Monument.
Yeah.
And we were like, whoa, they're in DC. And then we really wanted there to be an ape instead of Abraham Lincoln.
Ape Lincoln. Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so I'll just bring in my first like then. Since Julia kind of took the visual aspect, which was something I did want to talk about. And thank you, Julia, because that is something I thought was really cool about this. I will just take up the concept, because I really like the idea of a society structured around sort of limited age, and this idea that you would sort of die at the end, but then you would sort of like work somehow. We never see how this works, but somehow you would try to advocate for renewal, so you would be like reborn, which seems like a kind of weird science fictional take on reincarnation. I don't know if the film quite addresses it well enough, but I enjoy the concept as a kind of utopian society gone horribly wrong. And so I really, really appreciated that element. Even the scene, and this is something I'll talk about a little bit more specifically later, like where we first see Carousel actually taking place. I feel like from a viewer's perspective, we all recognize they're being blown the fuck up. But that sense at which, like, this is so normal, it's not a big deal, really comes through in the film. And I really like that attempt to sort of represent that as being sort of normal. And this is just how this society functions, even though from the outside we're recognizing what's actually occurring. So I see Jen wants to jump in and yell at me. So go on, Jen, yell.
Well, I think they actually do deal with that whole how they think it works. idea in terms of, you know, what happens after they die, but they don't die. They're reborn or renewed.
Only sometimes. They're not always renewed.
But you pretty much get the idea that there's a very good chance that you will be renewed if, as long as you work hard towards something. They never deal with that part. Like,
sure.
What makes you be renewed? But they do talk a lot about the one for one. One person dies and another one is reborn, which is why they have numbers in their names.
Right.
And which is why he is, you know, sitting there trying to wake up Logan 6, 7, the baby that will replace him. And yeah, they're Logan. Cool with that.
Right, because they're raised in a society where that's considered normal.
Not just normal, but celebrated.
Yeah, and that's something I don't want to dive into too much, because it is actually one of my likes.
Gotcha.
And it's something I think that we all could probably talk about a lot more, the emotional element in the film, if that makes sense.
Yes.
But I see Rachel also wanted to sort of interject. You want to add something, Rachel?
It's just the impression that I got is that they're kind of being told that, you know, if the carousel, you can be renewed and survive somehow. But the impression I really got from, like, the dystopian underpinnings of the quasi-utopian world was that everyone dies.
Yeah.
It's just a happy lie they tell the plebes to keep them being like, yay, carousel, let's all go to a musical.
I think that's explicit in the scene where where Logan interrogates the computer asking if anyone's been renewed and the computer doesn't answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The question has been answered. The question has been answered, Logan 5. Yeah.
The questions the computer doesn't answer are really, really interesting. Because he keeps asking it questions, and the question, even sometimes when it answers questions, it doesn't answer satisfactorily, right? It answers this kind of very canned response, which I really thought was really, that's the moment at which I think we recognize that he's sort of like, this system's messed up. Like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, I thought the system was good stuff. So... Yeah. David, did you want to jump in real quick?
Well, I wanted to second your what you said, that the really interesting idea of that, you know, this kind of sort of perpetual youth or everyone being allowed to be in their prime and then killed off as they hit 30. I think that idea the film does really well. And I think in shifting the ages from 21 to 30 from the book, it does some things better than the book. Though it keeps some of the, you know, never trust anyone over 30 sort of element from the 60s, it avoids most of the get off my lawn, cane shaking aspect of the book, which actually climaxes with Logan realizing says that the dying young is a waste and a shame and a perversion. The young don't build, they use. The wonders of man were achieved by the mature, the wise, who lived in this world before we did. So so that kind of sort of youth paranoia that's so present in the book is less in the film. Rather, this desire to stay young it seems to be encoded as well in their deaths, right? That they live up until the point where now we're going to start getting decrepit. We're wiped out and maybe we'll be renewed.
Well, I guess the question I would have, do you think that the film implies that when they finally get to sort of the inner workings of the city, and Logan even says at one point, right, it looks like none of this has been used, right, in a long time. We see the sort of waterworks, and he suggests to us that it is some kind of breeding facility where they might make food or something, but we never really learn what it's actually for. But he notes very specifically, right, that this is decaying. Right, these inner workings of this city, and we don't know to what degree this actually affects the city proper, because the city is very decadent, I feel. I'm sorry, go ahead, David.
No, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I just felt like that the cities, the dome cities, feel decadent, but when we get to how those cities would actually be, how they would actually work, the inner workings of how food would be distributed, we see the kind of decay on the outer outskirts. You even see that in that weird moment with the Cubs, right? Where they go to the city where all of the kids are like just hanging out and being violent. And that sort of area is super decayed because there's no incentive to sort of fix that area. So I feel like we get that sense on the outside, but I don't know if that's accurate. Maybe that's just kind of my reading. But
no,
I think it's definitely there, and this is a system that's in decay, right? That it cannot the people aren't really being renewed, and the system can't renew itself. It is destined to collapse. All Logan ultimately does is speed up the process, and its destruction comes entirely from within, right? It's the computer that can't process and blows everything up. We never get a sense of, how this was built, how it all came into place is just, it's sort of gestured at, and we're seeing the end, right? When all the people who are still there don't even remember how it all worked or how it was supposed to work. And so it's all falling to pieces. And I think it's probably smart that it doesn't go into too much detail trying to explain how this all came to be. The explanations in the book wind up, I think, making suspension of disbelief collapse faster than simply giving us a sense of here it is, that's all you really need to know, and you have a sense of it falling apart at the edges.
All right, fair enough. Jen, last quick comment, and then we got to move on to dislike.
Paul was first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Paul, go ahead.
Skip it. Let's move on.
Yeah, no, go ahead and move on.
Okay.
I'm sure it'll come back up again anyway.
Okay, so we'll go in opposite order for dislikes, just because I feel like being weird. So I will just start, and I will just say that I dislike Box, the robot.
No!
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to get so much hate right now.
Actually, Sean, yeah, I am right there with you. That was, like, in capital letters on mine, where I was like, okay, what the fuck is this robot even? That is literally what I wrote in my notes.
Box is my
overwhelming, is he not?
Okay,
so, yes, he is.
So let me explain why I dislike the robot Box. So one is that I don't see the purpose of him being in the narrative at all. He's just kind of this random obstacle, when I feel like the more interesting obstacle is Francis, and we don't... Basically, we get Box as this kind of interlude between what will eventually be Francis's final confrontation in what I assume is the Library of Congress. So Box just kind of appears, and he's this sort of super clunky robot. Like, he sort of runs on wheels, he lives in this weird ice cave, and he freezes people for reasons that aren't exactly clear to me and aren't explored, because then, of course, Logan has this bizarre... really lame fight with him where he like shoots off his arm, and then like he fights him, like they have like a fake wrestling match, and then he defeats him magically. It felt like they could have done something good with it, because Box does have some interesting dialogue that made you kind of wonder, like he repeats as Paul did at the beginning of the episode, right, the idea about plankton and the food and all these kinds of things, and we sort of get the sense, as we talked about, David, right, that sense of decay, because Box is a representation of that, right, the food that was coming and then is no longer coming, but it just felt super clunky. The robot it really did feel like they just put some like cheap ass cardboard and tinfoil over some wheels, and they just had it run into a room that looked like it was full of ice, and it was never explained why he was freezing people. He was just kind of freezing them and like whoop-de-doo, and then they just move on, and it's like there's a whole bunch of fucking frozen people. They're like they're peepsicles, right, in ice things, and nobody's exploring that. Nobody's talking about what's going on with those people. They just move on like it's no big deal. They destroy the robot. It doesn't affect Francis in any way. I don't know, it just felt like this moment of giant robot being weird, and that we just wanted to have a robot, we're done. Just didn't work for me. So, Rachel, I'm guessing that was your dislike.
Well, so this is the thing. I liked the concept of the robot. I thought he had, like, I actually really liked the stuff he said. And the other thing I wrote down in my notes was, like, this is the Soylent Green is people moment right here. But then the fucking robot looked like... I don't even... His arms, they look like, you know, you would plug it between a dryer and the vent in the wall.
Well, but remember,
like,
he...
So the problem was that the robot looked so... Like, you know, I whined about the robots in the black hole, and now, Paul, I am sorry, because I have now seen how much worse it could have been.
Well, remember, too...
Where is the blender of death? I want Maximilian back.
Well, remember, too, Rachel, that he doesn't get the weird guns on his arms until all of a sudden... Right, they just appear out of somewhere. He, like, farts out guns on his arms.
No, like I said, the robot, that was the problem, is they had this cool concept, and, like, the shit the robot was saying, like, you know, basically being like, oh, yeah, I'm freezing these people because I freeze protein, and that's my job, and now I'm going to feed them to you. And you're like, oh, shit, Soylent Green is people. That was really cool. He was cool as a design of the decay. But the design on the robot was so hilariously, terribly bad that it just entire scene and just pooped all over it.
How else are they supposed to get Roscoe Lee Brown into a robot costume?
You know what? They could have just had him voice it, and they could have borrowed the fucking, you know, they could have borrowed Maximilian. Oh, wait, except the black hole was after this movie. But, like, yeah. I was sitting there going, I weep for, like, the sophisticated special effects of the blender of death.
I like that at one point you can actually see his mouth on the inside of the robot.
Oh, no.
It's amazing.
No, you can totally see his mouth moving the entire, like, oh, it made me, that just that whole thing made me so crazy because the terribleness of the robot costume was so distracting from what could have been a really intense and super creepy scene, but the robot was just terrible.
Do you think he was, like, actually on, like, a, like, robotic wheels and somebody was, like, riding him around with, like, a remote control?
No, I'm pretty sure that's what it was, because if you looked at the way he moved, either he was on, like, something where he was controlling it, or he was, like, on a little remote controlled platform, because he'd kind of, like, jerk forward and stop. It was like they put him on someone's little RC car and were like, you know, riding him around. It was bad. It was so bad. I hated it so much.
Fair enough. Okay, so does anyone else have any hate for the robot?
I do, but mostly when he laughs. I just don't see why robots laugh sometimes.
He's not a robot!
Thank you.
What?
I will save this for later, but he's not a robot, and they say it in the movie.
Okay.
But David's going to want to address this later, and maybe I will too, so I will stop.
And Julia.
And I missed something, so that's awesome.
Okay. Yeah, obviously I missed something too. Well, you know what? Even if he wasn't a robot, his costume was even fucking dumber.
Fair enough. All right. Well, we'll sideline this, because this is going to come up as some likes. So, Julia, give us your first dislike.
Okay, so my first dislike is going to go to a more serious place, and that's, man, even though I love the aesthetic of this movie, and I thought it actually did the YA dystopian better than most YA dystopians that are currently on the market right now, I was sad about the women and the people of color in this movie. There were, like, a couple people of color, but apparently, like, only a couple survived the end of the world. And there were women in this movie, but it didn't really pass the Bechdel test.
True.
So, it was not the best evs for women, and Jessica Six was not the best ever strong female character.
No.
Like,
no.
She mostly just kind of damseled a lot, and even though her dress was very prettily torn, that was kind of sad.
That is fair. That is a fair point. Do any women talk to... Well, Farrah Fawcett sort of talks...
They talk to each other, but they mostly talk about men.
And they're seriously infantilized.
Yeah. And, like, most of the time, like, when Farrah Fawcett has her big scene, when she comes through and she's like, he's, like, horrible and he killed the doctor. And they're like, no, he's a runner. He's a runner, remember? And then she's like, oh, he's a runner.
That scene is
so it's like, really, it's all about Logan, and they're all just there to be talking about men and supporting men and having sex with men.
Yeah, the film does... Yeah. No, I agree. I don't think the film does particularly well with its female characters.
Which is sad, because, like, they could have. Like, there's no reason that the women all had to be kind of lackluster and boring.
Right, and that's something that'll come up in one of my likes, I think, sort of tangentially, because there is something the film does that is sort of kind of related to this. I think it imperfectly does, or tries to do, maybe fails, but I really appreciated. But yeah, you're right. The female characters are not great.
And yeah. Like the people of color, there were a couple of them in the crowd. They didn't talk, so.
Yeah. Which is probably why I don't remember, because there are none.
I remember seeing just like one or two people of color at some point in crowd scenes, but that was it, and they also did not have any role to speak of. They were just extras.
That's unfortunate. Yeah. All right, well, Paul, you want to jump in?
Well,
your next...
My first big one is the one that is half of what Julia said. I have it as The Very White World. And yeah, I mean, the only speaking role by a person of color in this movie is Roscoe Lee Brown, and you can't tell he's a person of color. So, yeah, I mean, this movie is blindingly white. I didn't notice it way back in the day when I saw this, but this time, yeah, I was looking like, oh, there's one. Oh, of course they're not going to talk. It's just like, yeah, this is a very monochromatic future, very, very badly so. Yeah, this sort of thing irks me now. It's like, no, this is not the way you want to have your future to be represented. No how, no way.
Fair enough. All right, David, your first dislike.
Well, I said how much I liked the exteriors of the City of Domes and the skylines and so forth, but a lot of the interiors, a lot of the interiors were shot in malls and looked like a mall. That, I think, is one of the things that really dates the film. And I remember what I've experienced a number of times is I found that if you saw this film as a kid in the 70s, then it's like, oh, wow, this is awesome. Then you try to show it to someone more recently, and they look at you, and you're going, this is so great, and they look at you like you're out of your mind. And particularly when the first interiors come and everyone's running around in what looks like a fairly bog-standard mall with a spinning giant hand in it. The very boring regularity of the corridors, the mundanity of the escalators and such, the whole sense of wonder wasn't really working too well for quite a number of the interiors. Once we get to places like Box's Hangout, then it looks awesome. But Carousel itself, I think, looks great, but a lot of the other interiors are disappointing.
That is unfortunate. I like the big spinning hand.
Well, if I'm going to be perfectly honest, yeah, I love the big spinning hand. but the boring wall around it, I like less.
I like the big spinning hand in the still we see in the credits, where we see it's basically turned off and decrepit now.
Yeah,
I like that visual in the end. It's a nice counterpoint to the rest of the movie.
Fair enough. Rachel, was your dislike the robot, or did you want to add something new?
I can add something new.
All right, go for it.
Let's see. The one major complaint I do have about the movie is that, particularly when you get to the third act, it just goes on and on. And
stealing
on.
My dislike.
I was just like, you know, this is one where I was not like, I wasn't checking the time. I wasn't being like, oh my God, until they got out of the dome. And then I was like, is this movie over yet? How much time is left? Get to the point. So, which is unusual, because normally where movies tend to have a bloat problem is like first or second act. And this one was just like the third act that never wanted to fucking end.
You notice what happened, the way the film is structured, in that the first half is almost nothing but tiny, each scene is really short. It's like a whole bunch of little incidents, boom, 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 right? Tiny, discrete adventures that last like a minute. And then once they get outside, then now it's just one story. And then the wind just goes out of the sails.
Interesting. All right. Yeah. Fair enough, Rachel. Jen, did you just want to piggyback on Rachel or add one new
one? Yeah, I'm just going to go with piggybacking off Rachel, because that really... I definitely was checking Twitter for the second half of the film.
Ooh, burned.
Ouch.
It's slow, you know, and it's unfortunate, because one of my favorite things about the movie is in the second half, but the majority of it is just lovingly gazing at DC in decrepitude, and I only needed like one shot of that. I didn't need about 5,000 of them, so it was a little bit frustrating because most of it was completely unnecessary.
It does seem like they could have trimmed the film if they had just made Logan. I don't know how they do it, but to remove the fact that he's a Sandman, or at least move forward the element of him sort of doing the running thing to make it much quicker. They could have sort of trimmed back some of that, but you're right.
I don't know. I think we need to establish that because otherwise he doesn't have a character growth and arc.
Well, I'm not even sure he has that much of character growth, or if he does, it's sort of like he falls off a cliff kind of character growth. Like, it just sort of appears? Because remember, his reasoning for going to look for Sanctuary is initially to have it destroyed.
Yeah, right? But there's 30 minutes of them looking for Sanctuary.
Right, with Ankhs, by the way, which...
No. I mean, I'm talking about after they get outside.
He's questioning his role in his life even before that.
Yeah.
And you see it from the beginning, and you see him... Going, when we enter the movie, he's already wondering why he has to die and why these people have to die and whether anyone gets renewed and what's going on. And he's still, like, in firm Sandmen are good territory, but he's questioning it. And then, like, his resolve that they're good completely falls away as he realizes that everything is completely different and not so great.
Yeah, all of that's fine. They could have just cut 20 minutes of them walking up the stairs.
Well, fair.
That said, like, I actually think that my entire group of friends agreed that this movie was really well-paced, and we all did not get bored and enjoyed it all the way through, and compared it to Zardoz, which we felt had a very similar artsy 70s science fiction True. Kind of through line, and which also got a passing grade from Torture Cinema.
It did?
But... well, at least we gave it a passing grade. I don't know if everybody did, but I think I gave it a C. And my friend group agreed that, like, you know, it was not a bad film. It was trying to do something, and it had some good things going for it. But it had terrible pacing compared to this. This had really great pacing, I thought.
That's fair. Yeah, I have to rewatch Zardoz, which I'm probably not going to actually do. I will say that it does seem like the 70s... does try to do interesting things with the genre. And this is another example of that, right? We've watched Zardoz, as Julia mentioned, right?
And the
Omega Man, both which had very interesting ideas, although I think the Omega Man, in my opinion, was a little less effective. But Zardoz, I found, like, it didn't work, but it had so many interesting things going on, which made it really fun to watch. In terms of trying to see how it would work with that. And I felt the same way about Logan's Run, that it was trying to do some very interesting things, maybe not entirely successfully, but far more interesting in its failure to actually achieve what it was trying to achieve than, say, a film
and
that wasn't trying.
And then you add in Star Wars, and I kind of have to say that maybe the 70s was the golden age of the science fiction movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that may be true. That may be fair. David may disagree, but...
Well, there's so much really going on, but though at the same time, if you look at the 50s, there was, just the avalanche of classics you have coming out of that.
But the 70s, I mean, would you agree, David, that the 70s generally look really good for science fiction?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's lots of really interesting things going on, which I think is why I find it, for instance, so laughable that we get a Hugo No Award for the Logan's Run's year, right? And the nominees were Logan's Run, Carrie, The Man Who Fell to Earth. Well, Future World, fair enough. There was a lot of really interesting stuff going on. And ironically, in some ways, Star Wars helps bring a stop to that.
Yeah, well, Star Wars definitely turns us toward the sort of like action-packed space opera without thinking too much about deep ideas. I have a question for you, David, if you remember this, or you, Paul, or anyone who might have actually been alive during the time that this Hugo year
God, I feel old, David.
Well, because this Hugo year happened before I was born, and I know I looked it up and I saw that there had been no award winning that year. But I didn't know why. I can't imagine. Like, given that lineup, it seems to me like those are amazing movies. Why would no award win?
Well, it won, and they gave a special award to Star Wars, even though I guess it wouldn't have qualified until the following year. But I mean I don't know. I think I was wondering that myself. I think it says something really interesting about a particular taste. And granted, I mean, Logan's Run was not well received when it was released. It was a bomb and largely critically derided. But Carrie and the Man Who Fell to Earth were very well received. Does it perhaps say something that there was a turn away from those films, saying, no, we don't want to give an award to The Man Who Fell to Earth. We're going to give something else special instead to the whiz bang Flash Gordon movie. that has given us all the special effects that we hadn't quite seen since 1968 with 2001.
And there was such a clamor. I mean, I've seen some magazines and stuff of the time talking about hopes for, and they were still calling it at the time, the Star Wars, that, yeah, I think that once Star Wars came along, none of the Hugo nominees stood a chance and it's lightened.
But it wasn't even eligible that year. Like, give it to Star Wars the next year.
Right, but Star Wars just had such an immediate impact on fandom that I think it overshadowed, even if it, because Star Wars came out May of that year, right around Hugo voting time, and so I think they took one look at Star Wars, took a look at the nominees, and thought like, none of these matter, even if it's not eligible. I mean we don't have the voting records from that far back. I only think they started compiling those losers party in the early 80s, so we don't know what the voting was, but that's my intention. My suspicion is with David that Star Wars just changed what we think of as science fiction cinema permanently.
Fair.
Well, I'm just going to throw this out there to any listener who happens to be listening and who remembers that year of Hugo voting. If you want to write us a note at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com or talk to us on Twitter or hunt us down in person, perhaps at Convergence. And I'd love to hear your story of how that year was for Best Dramatic Presentation Long Form, and what you felt about it and what you felt other people felt about it. Because I just love to hear from the source what people were thinking.
Fair enough. And I think,
I saw one comment about the terrible 70s movies, terrible 70s science fiction movies, and how it all turned around starting with Star Wars. If I'd been drinking, I would have spurted it out my nose at that point, because, I mean, granted, there were some really good films that followed in the wake of Star Wars as well, but I think that does a tremendous disservice to all the really interesting and often very, very intellectually ambitious work that was happening, not always successfully, but really swinging hard.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, without Star Wars, we wouldn't have had the black hole.
On a more serious note, I will say that I appreciate ambitious failure, right? Because I love the attempt to try to do something interesting, even if it fails miserably. Because that just is so much more that's much more interesting to think about than just kind of run-of-the-mill, we're just going to have lasers and just shooty-shoot-mc-shoot. That's not as compelling if it's as something that maybe, like Zardoz. I love Zardoz. It's not a good movie. It fails miserably, but it does so many interesting things. It's a film you could watch again and again and think about all the kind of weird shit that happens in that film. This is another film. I've seen Logan's Run twice now, and every time I'm like, this is doing so many interesting things. It doesn't succeed in every sense, but it is a film that is, I think, worth thinking about its ideas, the way it's playing with dystopia and all these kinds of mythical qualities. So I find that much more valuable than just maybe another Flash Gordon film. Although Flash Gordon's fun, but...
So I'm just going to throw this out there. Should we make the next round of likes and dislikes a speed round?
I think so, yes. Because we are at 1 hour and 3 minutes.
Yeah, so. we're not succeeding at making these shorter.
Yeah, making this...
That's because this movie is actually a really good movie and should not be in torture cinema. This should have just been a
Star
Wars.
It should have
been. There's actually things to talk
cinema.
About. As
it is true.
To,
it's yeah. true. You know. All right, so now for our second likes, the lightning round. Jen, why don't you jump in?
Peter Ustinov. He's amazing. Amazing. And he should be in the entire movie. But only him, waxing poetic about cats.
Oh, yeah.
Quoting
yeah.
Eliot.
And it should
like
be an
just,
entire
just
movie.
Just reciting T.S. Eliot poems.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He was really adorable.
With children touching his wrinkles adoringly.
Yeah, I had that down as a like. I'm crossing it off now.
He's amazing. That's all I gotta say.
He is adorable, Jen. I will definitely give that to you.
You know, and that's what was so frustrating about the second half, is that it took them a half hour to get to him in the first place. And then even his part, I love his dialogue, but at the same time, it's a little bit long-winded. So, you know, I was really torn between, oh my god, so lovable and adorable, I just want to squeeze his cheeks, and seriously get him off the screen. So...
He didn't actually need to do the entire cats.
No.
Yeah. At the same time, I found it really endearing.
Exactly.
Yeah, but just to the point, this is before the musical, so it wasn't as well known back then.
No, it wasn't as well known, but he still could have... We could have seen just a small excerpt of that and not all of it. Because people still knew Eliot back then.
Fair enough. I will say that I appreciate that in the future, people will become like super cat people. That's very nice.
Yeah, pretty cool.
I mean, when you're the only human and your companions are cats, I guess you have no choice.
His cats seem well-behaved. So.
And well, yeah, they're very clean and they look well-fed.
Fair enough.
And I bet a lot of his dialogue was improvised.
Yes.
It feels like it.
Because there's just
yeah.
so much of it and the way it flowed and it sounded like a different script.
It did. Exactly,
that's fair.
Which is why I needed him in a different movie. I just wanted to take him out and put him in a whole different film that was entirely dedicated to the old man and his cats.
Okay,
the
fair
Library
enough.
Of Congress.
All right, we got to jump to Rachel. Next. So, Rachel, your second like. Go quick.
My second like is, I wrote this down for you, Sean. Hey, look, there was an opening thing with writing on it that a narrator did not read
Thank
to us.
Thank fucking God. Yes.
Which only goes to show that science fiction in the 70s was much more sophisticated.
Because it didn't include narrators reading the on-screen text. Yes. Because every fucking movie we've watched that has had on-screen text, somebody has read it to me, and I'm so fucking tired of it. I can read, damn it.
Here's where I have to confess that I couldn't actually read the text, and I had to get someone to read it out loud to me.
Oh no!
This is because I have bad eyesight.
Okay.
Yeah, see, it's actually useful.
So
for some
actually
people.
Having a narrator read the text is useful to me.
Fair enough. All right. David, your next like.
Box, because he was so awesome. His final line of dialogue before he attacks, it's my job! All the frozen people, which explains where all the other runners went, and all of his sculptures and stuff, and man, I was haunted for years afterwards with Box's voice going, my birds, when it all comes crashing down. It was so weird, so bizarre. I love that cyborg to death.
Do you want to explain the not a robot thing?
He says he's a fusion of, he explains being a fusion of man and machine, surpassing both.
Yep.
So he's flesh and metal.
Except he says it in much better voice, because
yes,
he's Roscoe Lee Brown.
Because he's Roscoe Lee Brown, yeah.
Okay, I missed that line.
Fair enough. All right, Paul, second light, go.
Box, because, well... Yes, he is a cyborg, more than man, more than machine, more than either, and he's equally creepily different from the version in the book. The version of the book is very different and is creepy as hell, and this one is creepy in very different ways. He just wants to freeze them for protein. It's awesome.
Totally normal. That happens.
Totally normal. I'll tell you later what he wants to do in the book.
Fair enough. All right, Julia, go.
box forever. Can I just say, like, fish and plankton and protein from the sea?
From the sea.
And, like, so the whole time, you know, they come out and they're like, what's going on? And you're like, he seems friendly. Maybe he's going to feed them. Oh, no, he's going to turn them into food. Ah, and it is. It's very plot relevant because it does tell you where all those runners went. And ostensibly, Logan is supposed to be finding out what happened to all those unaccounted for runners. How could they possibly have disappeared? And did they make it to sanctuary? No, they made it to food storage. We have also seen that the place where maybe they were breeding food or something is decaying and decrepit. So it's really unclear to me whether those things are staying frozen forever or whether they're being fed into the system of the city and made into the matter that eventually becomes consumed by the people who live there. Like, I wondered personally while watching this if the city itself wasn't kind of like slowly decaying and there wasn't necessarily even a one-for-one ratio anymore because maybe it couldn't support that much life anymore. So it was slowly dwindling.
Interesting.
Good point.
But box forever. Box is awesome.
Fair enough.
So I love the fact that, like, you could actually see his mouth moving behind because it kind of reminded me of the Mechanical Turk. And if you've never heard of the Mechanical Turk, look it up on Wikipedia.
Oh, there, yeah. Murray Robinette Kowal mentioned that in the episode we did last year, I think.
Yeah,
Mechanical Turk.
Yeah, the chess player.
That's right. Yeah. Just a note for those wondering, like, all of the runners, there was something like 1,000+ people who were unaccounted runners. I don't know how long they've been unaccounted for, but clearly they've been peepsicles for a while. So, fun. So my second like, I will just say that I appreciated, and I mentioned this earlier, that I wanted to talk about the emotion, so I'll just be really brief. I love Francis, how he becomes almost psychotically emotional. We see kind of the precursor to that when they're all at Carousel and everyone's sort of celebrating in this weird kind of almost cathartic, like, they're yelling at the people as they're being disintegrated, essentially. But Francis, who is Logan's friend, who follows him as he's sort of initially doing this mission for the computer, right? He becomes so psychotically enraged to the point that he's just emotionally uncontrollable at the end when they sort of had their final confrontation at the library. I love that element because it kind of shows the way in which this sort of very emotional society, or at least channeled emotion, results in very negative consequences, particularly for its individual characters. Like, Logan kind of learns to kind of let go a lot of the things that he has issues with, but Francis can't. He's so embedded in it that he wants to preserve it, and that makes him incapable of rational judgment. And I really liked that. We could see it coming, by the way, very early on, because the very first scene when Logan and Francis actually chase after a runner, right, it's almost psychotic. It feels like they're playing It's sadistic.
Oh, yeah, they are definitely sadistic.
Right, it feels like cats playing with mice, mm-hmm. is what it feels like, right? And Logan jokes at one point. He's like, oh, I missed. And Francis is like, well, I had to fix it because you were missing so much. He's like, right? But it feels like it was all deliberate. It was all very measured and played out. It's very creepy. So that's my like. I appreciated that emotional element and the way it played out in the narrative. So there we go.
Well done.
Okay, so second dislikes. Jen, we're going the other way around, aren't we? Okay.
Yeah, you again.
All right, I'll go really quick then. Farrah Fawcett is terrible. I'm sorry, but she is. It's not necessarily her, it's the character that she plays. She plays this kind of ditzy receptionist. And I just feel like everything about her character is really awful, and that's a flaw in the writing. That, like, we get to that scene, which we've mentioned before, where they're, like repeating to her, like, but he really wasn't doing the thing you think he was doing, and she's like, oh, you're right, he wasn't doing that. It feels very manipulative, like she didn't have much in the way of a character to begin with. She's just kind of this tool that's being used to kind of convey, I don't know, the narrative, or just to push the narrative forward. I just hated her character. It felt incomplete, I guess, is what I would say. And ditzy in parts, in a way that was very negative. So that's what I would say. And if nobody has anything to add, then Julia, you should definitely go with your second dislike.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. Her character was terrible. But I don't really have anything to say because I covered that in the women part.
Fair enough.
That said, my second dislike is that even though I thought this was a fantastic movie and I had a lot of fun with it and I thought it worked as well or better than a lot of the dystopian YA I have read, there were still some plot holes that didn't make a whole lot of sense. And like, I was coming up with backstory, so I was coming up with the whole Box is actually feeding those frozen runners to the people. I don't know if that was actually true or if he was just storing them. And if he was, where was the city getting food? If some of it was decaying and what was even happening there? How were runners possibly unaccounted for? Like, if the system could see them every second, like, where did they think they were running to? Because the city didn't seem all that big, and it seemed like the Sandmen had a pretty good lead on where everyone was. So I was sort of like, huh, how is this underground even working? And then once you get outside, like, how is that old man alive? Like, how is the world not a problem and no one knows? If he's the only one alive, how is he the only one alive? And why are there so many cats? Like, how did cats survive? There were some definite plot holes in there that I was like, we could have had some things that didn't make entirely a lot of sense. But
Julia?
Yes?
The cats survived because they always land on their feet.
Yeah, but if you're, like, radiated to death, I'm not sure that matters. Like, cockroaches I would buy, but cats, I'm not sure.
Okay, this is the lightning round, so I'll talk about the radiation in the third round. It has to do with the book.
Oh, fair enough.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, that was the other thing that I wanted to add into this little bundle. And that's, I haven't read the book, but my friend Tori was like, did you read the book? Because you said you were going to try to find it. And I was like, no, it was out of print. She's like, well, I read the summary on Wikipedia. And apparently in that, Francis is like actually 42 and his palm crystal isn't working. So he's managed to escape the system's carousel thing. And basically he engineers it so that Logan can escape and he is not the same antagonist. And I was like, wow, you know what? That actually, I would have liked to see that because it would have been really interesting
basically
Peter Ustinov and Francis are the same character in the book.
Okay. All right. Let's save this for a little bit later. We got to move on here. So Paul, your next one.
Okay. My second lightning round dislike is Logan and Jessica's first meet and Logan being very, very creepy in a very sexual way. Like, let's have sex. It's like, oh, why did you come here? Just it felt really, really creepy to me how much he was trying to pressure her into having sex with them. I mean, yeah, I know that's why she go in the circuit, but still, it's just like, ugh. It felt really, really wrong.
That was probably because of what he was wearing.
Okay.
That didn't help.
Also because he was trying to coerce her into having sex after she said she wasn't interested.
Yeah. No means no, Logan.
Yes, we'll come back to this a little bit later, I think. So I want to save some of that. Can we save some of it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fair enough. Because it is something that is, I'll talk about later. So... but fair enough, David, for Paul. So David, next.
Mine's connected to Julia's some of the plot holes, and mine specifically is Logan's motivation gets very blurry and confused since he's supposed at what point he's genuinely running and when does he stop trying to locate sanctuary so he can reveal it all.
I think it's Cathedral.
Well, and it seems like when he's after Cathedral, when they're meeting up with the Underground, right? And he signals the Sandmen to come to this place, and then in the same scene he starts shooting Sandmen. It's like, Logan, make up your mind. Whose side are you on there? And then after that, he seems to be genuinely running. But the moment of him calling in the cavalry like that, sort of completing his mission, we suddenly have two completely opposed motivations that are cheek by jowl in that moment. It just doesn't make any sense.
Fair enough. All right.
I agree.
Rachel, you want to jump in?
All I can say is I have a very low tolerance for super trippy bullshit scenes. So what the fuck was the club scene when Logan and Jessica, like, what even was that? Yeah, I didn't like that. Dislike.
It was interpretive sex.
I guess.
It's a twisted version of the glass meeting place I told you about in the book. It's a
so very, very twisted version of it. Is interpretive sex a college course from the 70s?
Yes, it was very clearly so. Yeah. Yeah. You could also take interpretive basket weaving.
I actually really liked that scene because of the whole idea that if what they're escaping to an extent is the hedonism of youth, culture, and the world that's been created, then it all makes sense.
Well, we will come back to this later, Jen, because I will have something related to Rachel's. So, all right, Jen, your next is like, go.
My next dislike actually is the not the very, very end, but the fact that the computer questioning Logan is what breaks the computer, which makes no fucking sense whatsoever. I'm sorry.
It's a very Star Trek sort of logic and put the logic and blow up the computer or even the prisoner. Like, the prisoner puts in information the computer can't handle. The computer goes boom.
I get it from that standpoint. It is something that's repeated throughout science fiction. But the logic of Sanctuary does not exist. Like, that not being logical to the computer is just absurd.
Fair.
The thing that we really needed right there was Jack Nicholson from A Few Good Men being like, you want the truth?
Right? You can't handle the truth. Exactly. I mean, it was just it was slightly painful to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. Agree, Jen. Totally agree.
Only ruins.
Would that have been an early use of holograms there, do you think?
Yes, yeah. It is, actually. Sure, like I read that somewhere. It was one of the first very great examples of 3D and whatnot. So.
Yeah, not a good choice.
I did like that. I liked the look of that scene. Award. I just did not like the outcome of it.
But yeah, very early example of 3D holograms. That visual effects award is where that's coming from,
probably.
I think.
Fair enough. All right, we're on to our third likes. Jen,
oh, goody.
Your third like, okay. Go.
My third like is that I get to watch Richard Jordan in his very first incarnation as Duncan Idaho.
Huh? Yeah.
Duncan Idaho.
Well, yeah, but I don't see how he's Duncan Idaho.
Because it's Richard Jordan being glorious. Before Dune. And any time that he's on screen being glorious and sexy and intense and unrelenting, he's obviously Duncan Idaho. And his loyalty to the system, it's all there. I'm madly in love with him. And I think he was actually the best part of the entire film.
I can tell,
Francis,
Jen.
Francis is a great character. His intensity is a really, really nice foil to Peter York's slow, steady quietude.
You mean Michael York?
Michael York, sorry.
Yeah, from Austin Powers, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
He's just a fun character. I really liked him. I'm disappointed, actually, now that I know what the character is in the book. I would have really, really, really liked to have seen him sink his teeth into that.
Fair enough.
That would have been amazing.
All right, Rachel, your next like. Your last like, in fact.
The final like.
Yes. We don't sing for that, though.
No, just only correct. For the dislike. I will just do a short and silly one. It's the fact that they heard a noise and it was only the cat.
Jump
and then
scare.
They did not die.
That's it?
Well, okay. I mean, we already did a lot of talking about the very meaty aspects of this. So the only other kind of like snarky like I have written down is Carousel is a pretty awesome Cirque du Soleil show.
And kind of reminiscent of those acrobats at the beginning of the Star Wars holiday special.
Oh, God, no. You know, I have not seen that, and I'm glad to keep it that way, so I will take your word for it.
Oh, Rachel, you have no idea what you're in for.
Oh, man, you're missing so much, Rachel.
Yes.
But see, I'm not in for anything because I don't have to watch it because you guys already watched it and you're not going to watch it again for Torture Cinema.
Unless somebody were to bribe us all to watch it again.
I was going to say, if people wanted to make that one of my Torture Rachel by giving money to charity things, I would watch it if people gave like $500 to charity.
I will just say that we will all be... Well, except for Jen, we will all be at Convergence this year, and I could most certainly bring it on a computer or other visual interface.
Oh, man. You know,
you should be making assumptions that you can keep me in the room.
Michael Thomas is going to be there, and I hear he watches it all the time for fun. Like, I hear he makes Lynn watch it.
Yeah.
Poor Lynn.
Yeah, it is. Okay, well, we'll save that. We'll save that. We got an event coming. We can do this. So... All right, David, why don't you jump in?
This is final likes. Yep. I guess the even though I had some criticisms of the pace overall, the pace, and I'm thinking again about my experience of this as a kid and what an incredible adventure movie this was, because every minute there was another adventure, right? First there being, we see Carousel, and then there's, we're exploring the world, and then all of a sudden he's up against the Cubs, and then there's the underground with their weird phallic, puff sticks, and then there's Box, and then there's the world was constantly throwing something at, and it's in much the same way, I guess, that Star Wars was consciously recreating the serials of the 1930s. Logan's Run feels like all of the episodes of a serial compacted into 2 hours, with one cliffhanger after another. Boom, 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 boom. And in this regard is very, very faithful to the book, which has the same structure and begins with a two-page dedication to all of the adventure books that the authors loved as kids. And watching that film again, I felt I still had that feeling of this gigantic world where there was adventure around every corner.
I super agree with that, and I want to add that the thing that impressed me the most was that it did that, but managed to preserve the through line the whole way through and make it feel like one cohesive whole.
Fair enough. Yep. All right, Paul, you want to jump in?
Yeah, my last like, I actually had more... several. I don't know which one to burn here. Okay, it's a small one, and it actually goes back to the scene I was talking about in my last dislike, but the casual acceptance of same-sex relationships in this movie. Because when he activates the circuit, the first thing he gets is a guy who smiles at him, so indicating that that is an option, and Logan dismisses it, and then later, when trying to try to creep on Jenny Agutter, he says, "Well, you like women." She says, "No." But it's not like no, that's disgusting. No, that's just not my thing. So in this world, clearly same-sex relationships are no big deal and nobody finds them strange. And that's pretty progressive for the 1970s, I think.
100% agree, Paul, because that was something I noticed too. It wasn't one of my likes, but it was something that I really loved, that it was sort of casual. There wasn't a big deal made out of it. He didn't like sit there and go, "I'm totally sickeningly grossed out." It was just sort of, here's this thing.
He swiped.
Yeah,
right.
He's like, like Tinder, right? Yeah,
that's actually what one of my friends said was like they are using Tinder.
Basically, yeah.
And I did also appreciate that. Basically, what he says when she's like, "Oh, I changed my mind. I'm not into this." He's like, "Do you prefer women?" And it's not like, "Are you gross that way?" It's just sort of like, "Oh, did I pull a lesbian by accident?"
Oops. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I do love that because it's the 70s and it's like, I don't know why I feel like it would not be normal, but it's very nice that it's just sort of casual. It's just like, yeah, you could put yourself in the circuit and you could get a dude or a woman or whatever you want. You can basically get whatever you want. It's all good. So,
in other words, very much the 70s.
Yeah, well, that's fair. That's fair. I wasn't in the 70s because I wasn't born until 83. So,
young one.
Baby.
Youngling.
Fair enough. All right, Julia, your last like. Go.
My last like is tiny, but it is something I genuinely gleefully took delight in. And that is, it's kind of a silly moment, and it's kind of an eye-rolling moment because it's basically the Michael Bay moment of this movie. When they're outside and they're sitting on a rock and a lizard crawls up Jessica Six's skirt, and she freaks out, and she just like, ah! And then she finds it and so flips it off of her, and she's like, I hate outside. And I was like, that is me in camping. Like, I need that reaction gif. So that anytime somebody's like, you want to go camping? I could just be like, Jessica Six, I hate outside.
That's pretty much how I feel about outside, which midfield camp as a geologist really a special experience for me, let me tell you.
I mean, I love walking outside as long as nature doesn't have to touch me too closely. Like, any crawling thing on me is not okay.
No. Or dirt. Or too much sun. No.
Fair enough, Julia. That is totally fair. Okay, so should I go to my last like?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. So I mentioned I was going to bring this up, and I wanted to bring it up here. I don't think the film deals with this very well, but it tries to, which is the question of consent, which is like when it's brought up a number of times, right? When Logan goes to the circuit, he's looking for people to have sex with, and presumably the circuit is like, if you put yourself in there, that means you're interested in having sex. It's sort of like Craigslist casual encounters, right? So he gets her, but she's like, eh, I put myself in there because I was, like, emotional and I actually don't really want to do it. And he does kind of pressure her, but it is important, I think, to note that he never actually forces himself. He sort of gets to that point where he wants to, but he stops because she says no. She repeats no, and then it comes up again much later when they're in the water together, and she sort of, like, basically gives consent. I don't think the film deals with it perfectly. I think that there's obviously problematic elements to it, but I appreciate that the film makes that very explicit, that consent is actually important in this future, that if he was to force himself upon her, it would be considered unacceptable. I think that's implied. And so I love that the film does do that explicitly. Like, it's explicit. She has to say yes, or at least basically yes.
does that make sense? I have to disagree a little bit, only because okay. You have a very... The only reason that he respects her no is because Francis comes in with the two other chicks. And
no, that's not true.
The love shack, I think it is. And then the love shack, that requires, as long as you walk in, that's implied consent.
The love shack is problematic, certainly. That's yes, a weird place because I feel like everyone in there is on drugs.
They are.
Well, they are. There's massive amounts of pheromones that are being pumped in. That's why you're seeing all of the characters kind of reacting weirdly because they're having to fight their own reactions there. Like they're about to falling prey to the very air.
Right, and I feel like that's in stark contrast to the sort of love, whatever it's called, the love circuit, where people are essentially implying consent, but that they can revoke that consent at any point. Which does come up, right? She says explicitly, she says, I was feeling bad and I thought this would be the thing to do, but now I feel like it's a total mistake. Now that, I don't know why she does that.
It still seemed like it required her to escape.
Yeah, basically when Frances comes in with those two girls, she runs away, and that's why they don't have sex.
Yeah.
I agree that it does do a little bit better than some of the other movies in the same time period, but I don't think it, like, wins the award on consent at all.
That's fair. I mean, I don't think it's entirely successful. I think it tries to make it an explicit concern. I think it fails in a number of points, because he does almost force himself upon her a number of times, but I think that it comes almost full circle when they're in the water and they have this what would I guess be considered a romantic gesture where she's like, you could have any woman and what is it you want, and she's like, I know, and then she's like, yes, and then it's all happy. I don't know if they actually do it, but whatever, it's assumed that
I assume that they do. I also think that is actually a good point, because I think that one of the things that struck me about it is that in the beginning, Logan's basically a cop.
Yeah.
So he has, like, a really unfair power dynamic, and he has a sense of entitlement to match it. And this movie knows that and is basically making him be a controlling, entitled cop jerk to her at the beginning. And by the time they actually do get around to having sex, his character has changed enough that he waits for her to actually want it and initiate it.
That's fair. Yeah, yeah. I think that's a really good reading. Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Julia. Okay, so where were we?
You're on your last dislike.
Oh.
And then we're done. Well, what was my last dislike? Of us have to do our dislikes, but then we're done.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah.
It's the final dislike.
Final dislike.
Okay, that just added five minutes. Hurry up.
Dislikes. I don't know what my final dislike is, so Julia, please just go, because I lost it.
Okay, so my final dislike, this is going to be easy, and I think it might make Paul feel slightly better, is that this movie was not immune to the terrible lasers that are a migraine trigger. It didn't go on for as long and it wasn't as much of it, but there was like a whole big laser battle where I basically had to cover my eyes with a thick piece of cloth so I couldn't see anything through them and wait until Moss told me it was okay to look again.
The new you scene?
Yeah.
I can see that.
That's fair.
Damn.
That's fair. Okay. I remember what my dislike was. And it's related to something you had said much earlier, Julia, which is the plot holes in the film. We've mentioned before, like, the old man, I really love him, he's adorable, and he's cute. But when we get to the very end of the film, the whole system basically, like, explodes, and all of a sudden, everybody's walking outside, which didn't make any sense to me, given that how complicated it was for them to get out of the city in the first place, right? Yeah. They had to go through, like, this water facility and all this shit. They had to fight a robot in ice. Like, they had to do all this stuff. And then all of a sudden, like...
Well, presumably all those people just swam for a long-ass time underwater, because that's how Logan and his friend got back in.
No, but where did they swim from? They came out in a different spot, though.
They came out at the top. How did they get there?
A previously deactivated sign reading emergency exit lit up when everything exploded, and they went out the door.
It actually isn't that horrible, because by the end, they remember that they're actually at surface level, and that the, you know, whatever gate that there are in the dome are at, you know, ground level, and they just
talk about seals, you know, like penetrate the seals, so the seals opened, and so we don't see them walking out of the dome because they probably didn't have the special effects budget for it, but that's what I assume would happen. Doors opened, and so they came out of the domes and came to the water.
Well, this is just dumber now. You're just making it sound even dumber.
It's headcanon, but I'm going
with it. Yeah, because, I mean, even if that's true, then what we end up with is just, like, a bunch of people, like, who all their lives, right, in generations of lives, they just sat and there's, like, this emergency exit, and they're like, let's not touch that. And then this is the generation when they decide to touch it. No, I mean, come on.
They have no reason to touch it.
I was kidding about the emergency exit.
I'm sorry.
Well, they didn't have, like, a sudden loss of cabin pressure until that point. And then the oxygen masks came out of the ceiling. They were like, we have to go.
You know, sex and food and
and also they were led to believe that the outside would kill them.
Yeah, but humans are not that stupid. Like, they're stupid, but they're different stupid. Like, humans are the kind of stupid where if you told them don't touch the thing, they'll touch the thing.
Well, like, but see Highlander 2. I mean, they don't know that there's a world above the world that they're living in that's habitable. And
I'm not even willing to admit that that is qualified as a movie.
they're in a bubble. They have no reason to think outside the bubble. But then the bubble quite literally bursts.
And then they mysteriously appear at the top. And then they manhandle an old man.
Yeah,
they want to touch the crevices in his face. Longer?
Do they hurt?
Do they hurt? Do those crevices hurt? Let me touch them. Let me run my fingers sensuously up and down the crevices.
I have never seen facial hair before because people under 30 don't grow it.
Let me touch it. I feel like after like an hour of that, like his face is just raw and the skin starts sloughing off. It's sad.
No, what's sad is that these.
Next, okay, yeah, go, Paul.
Okay, so my final dislike is that so much from the book actually doesn't wind up in the movie or winds up getting twisted in the movie in sometimes uninteresting ways. Like Cathedral, for instance. You know what? You remember that scene where Billy gets that thing and puts it on Logan's face and says muscle? There's a whole scene in the book about that, and basically what it is basically kind of like an amphetamine, and what it does in the book is it actually speeds up Logan's life clock as a result. But in the movie, it does absolutely nothing. It makes absolutely no sense. And there's so much else in the movie that we don't get to see, like the whole fact that Ballard and Francis are the same person, or the fact that Washington D.C. had gotten had a nuclear bomb set off, and so Washington D.C. is actually mildly radioactive, warmer than normal. And all the creatures in the Washington Zoo are wandering around, including a Siberian tiger, which at one point Logan has to deal with, in addition to all the cats and everything else. So,
and Sanctuary is in orbit around Mars.
Yes, and Sanctuary is in orbit around Mars. It misses all of this stuff. And not to mention the real box is actually this weird torture artist cyborg who captures the two of them after Logan winds up going to this prison in Alaska. And they try to get out, and boxes the way on the way out, and wind up poor Jessica winds up getting tortured, getting ready to be tortured and pulverized to death by a box before Logan uses special martial arts foo to break out of his prison, which I thought was cool in the book at the time. And not to mention, finally, last thing, oh, the guns horrible. in the movie, they just the fire guns. One thing. In the book, they have six different special settings. They got, you can't get away from a Homer. It's got homing missiles in the book, basically, and other things that we never see in the movie, and it's disappointing.
We do see green fire.
Yeah, it's not the guns in the book.
Fair enough. All right, David, bring in your next dislike. Go.
Well, my final dislike was the guns with their Bunsen burner flare and the flash pot explosions. Formidable, they were not. Or actually, to steal a line from Box, overwhelming, they were not.
But I loved them because they were not a migraine trigger.
No, they were. Disgust trigger.
That's fair.
Like, oh my God, what the hell is the point?
Fair enough. All right, Rachel, go ahead.
So my final dislike is that Logan, who has been like eerily calm through most of the movie, I mean, you know, he's very measured and doesn't really get that excitable, waits until the big moment, like the most important speech of his life, when he's trying to convince people to go outside to pour on the fucking crazy. And then he just sounds like a hobo who is like yelling insane things in the outdoor mall, and everyone laughs at him, which is, you know, fair enough, because he sounds like he's nuts.
He seems like it, though, because when you look at his face in comparison to when he's at Carousel, it's the same face.
Well, he gets all, like, wild-eyed, and I'm just like, Logan, slow your roll! Calm it down! This is not going to convince
anyone! It's the same emotional reaction he has at Carousel. It really is.
He comes in and he's like, don't go in there. You don't have to die. No one has to die at 30. You could live and grow old.
Yeah. And everyone's like, that sounds great. And plus, I mean, I'm sure some of them are kind of like, but you don't die. You get renewed because we believe the lies. Yay. I want to put on a Cirque du Soleil jumpsuit and go flying through the air on wires.
Oh, Rachel, I love you.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was just like, oh, Logan, why? I did not like that because it was so weird and it seemed so out of character because it's not like he'd been kind of cracking before then or anything. He just, like, gets inside and he's like, well, this is all the stress I've been saving up this entire time.
Fair enough. All right, Jen, your last dislike. You are the end of the show. Bring it.
I can't pick anything because my family have chosen this moment to interrupt me. This moment! Oh my god.
I will send poison in the mail later.
Go away! We're doing a
podcast. You bastards.
Oh, okay.
Time's ticking away, Jen.
So I'm going to go with... I honestly don't remember what the first opening credit thingy said. What did the scene say?
It's like the 23rd century and the world is set.
Do they ever actually say the cause?
Apparently, if you're a mutant that has 7 million boobs.
Oh, yes, there's war, right? And
But they never
basically post World War III.
Like for the longest time, I was under the assumption, you know, it's like, okay, so it's a post-apocalyptic world. It is, obviously. It's dystopian. And for whatever reason, they feel like they have to do population control because there's only so, you know, finite resources and whatnot. That's kind of what I had sat around assuming for most of my life in terms of Logan's Run, is that they kill you at 30 because finite resources and, you know, trying to keep humanity alive or something along those lines, because then you can't go outside because nuclear winter, and that's what they're discovering, is that there isn't actually nuclear winter, which makes it exactly like the 100, might I add, which is a great TV show and everybody should watch it. Didn't realize how much the 100 stole from Logan's Run until rewatching it. But now that I've seen it a second time, none of those motivations really seem to exist. And particularly knowing at least the bits and pieces that I do about the book, that the fact that it's actually 21 that's the cutoff age, and there's that whole sort of 1960s, 70s, you know, youth culture of we're going to take over the world and fuck the adults and all of that, then it really seems like, no, we just have this world because we hate adults. So what I dislike is that I'm really honestly not sure why the hell this city exists in the first place.
Trust me, Jen, the lack of explanation there is more convincing
probably
than the actual explanation we get in the book.
I want something. Anything.
Here's the back for the book. So by the early 1970s, over 75% of the people living on Earth were under 21 years of age. In the 1980s, the figure was 79.7%. In the 1990s, 82.4%. In the year 2000, critical mass. So somehow we get to a stage where something like 90% of the people on Earth are under 21.
Which makes no fucking sense.
I guess they assumed that the baby
like
boom
I would have
just
really liked
booming.
It if it was something like yeah. Okay,
and
the adults decided to fuck up the planet, so the kids went fuck you adults and we're going to kill everybody over the age of 30 because by the age of 30 you become corrupted somehow by age and greed and, you know, whatever.
Which
right.
was actually done I think the movie was gas.
It's been done,
right?
But I just needed a reason. And I never got one.
All right, fair enough, Jen. All right, well, this is the time when we need to grade this movie. Given that all of us didn't hate it, I suspect the grades will be above a C. But we shall see what you all come up with. So I'm going to start in backwards order, and we're going to start with you, Julia.
I'm going to give it a B+. I'm not going to give it an A because it really didn't do a good job with the women and the people of color and stuff. There were some issues with it, but I wholly enjoyed it and I would totally watch it again.
Fair enough. All right, Paul?
I'm going to go with Julia. I'm going to give it a B+. It's not. It misses a lot of the things from the book that I remember and loved. But this movie isn't bad. It really was not torture. I watched it actually a couple of times in the last week and did so willingly and happily, even given all its flaws.
All right, B+ and B+. All right, David.
Well, it sure was fun revisiting it again. There's lots of things that I really do like about it. The things that clunk do certainly for me. I think I'll probably go with a B.
B for you. All right, fair enough. Rachel.
I'll give it a B-.
B- for Rachel. Wow, this is shaping up so far to be the highest
because it's
rated
not actually torture
cinema movie.
Torture.
I know.
Yeah, It's really not.
I blame David.
I'll put on the hair shirt later. Yeah, it's totally my fault.
Sons of Steel got robbed.
Fair enough, because Sons of Steel was freaking amazing. It's only because the curmudgeon Jen was on that episode.
So much pain. Is it my turn to grade?
I just want it. I just rotten milk. Rotten milk nipples, Jen. All right, go for it.
I'm going to go with a C plus. Yeah.
C plus for you. All right. I would give it, I would give it a C plus as well.
Why so?
I liked it, but I felt like some of the pacing was off, and I felt like it was trying to do too many things. It was good, but it wasn't like really like. I'm thinking as a professor, like C is average. So C plus is like just slightly above average.
Plus, but the second half, I give like about a D plus, C minus. So
my C plus does not mean I hated the movie. I thought it was okay.
So what's our average for the film?
Alrighty.
B plus.
Oh,
B minus,
God
C plus, plus.
I think it's probably like a B minus.
It comes out to 2.85, which is
it's like a
B minus.
Yeah, it's that like a B minus.
Yeah, which is B minus.
Yep.
Just above a B minus,
which I think is the highest rating. I haven't checked, but we will. I'm gonna assume it's the highest rating. So
I remember what we gave Omega Man.
That's because this movie is actively good. Like it's not. It's not a bad movie. It's a good movie. It has a fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It has a fairly good rating on IMDb. It's generally a beloved science fiction classic that won an Oscar for a reason.
Yeah.
Omega Man only got an average of a C.
Yep, this is higher than, and I think that's fair, because I think Omega Man is the worst movie.
Well, I think that's also fair, because at least in Logan's Run, nobody went the full Jesus.
Fair enough. Alrighty, guys. Yes. Well, on that note, we need to close out the show. So if you have any thoughts about Logan's Run and you'd like to let us know what you think about them, you can go to skiffingfanny.com. All the other methods of contacting us will be at the end of the show. So thank you, Jen, for showing up out of the blue for this episode. I'm sure it was your pleasure.
I got to watch
Logan's Run.
Sure
you enjoyed yourself a great deal. That's fair enough. All right. Thanks, Rachel.
You're welcome, citizens.
Thanks, David.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Stay frosty.
And thanks, Julia.
Sure, and I want to reiterate, if you were alive and remember the Hugos from that year, I do really want to hear what your experience of that year was.
Yes, totally double confer what Julia said. If you were alive during that period and you remember anything about it, please send us a message.
Can we just like make like a sacrificial altar offering of like a bunch of old Worldcon programs and summon Kevin Stanley and have him answer all of our questions?
I mean,
like a
I'm
genie?
Pretty sure you just
three
have
times.
To say
you have to say it three times.
I'll say his name three times and he'll disappear.
I will put his name three times in the show notes. How about that?
There you go, yes. And get all of his friends. I'd really love to hear multiple perspectives of how people experienced the Hugo ballot for that year and the attitude towards best dramatic presentation long form.
I will do my best to put a note of that in the show notes and see if I can. I've talked to Kevin Stanley a couple times and see if we can get him to maybe share some thoughts on it. So, alrighty, guys. Well, on that note, I think we'll shut up now. Awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley. Last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.